Welcome to Cooking Rice, a series of interviews with people who are as deeply engaged in social transformation as they are in their own personal journeys. Cooking rice is taken from an ancient Asian proverb, well-loved and used by Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, to express his commitment and his social vision that inner knowing or wisdom alone is insufficient. Only when joined with transformative engagement with the world does the rice actually get cooked. This is your host, Marty Janowitz. In this episode, I had the opportunity to speak with Chuck Leaf, who I'll call the eclectic attorney. His career has been marked less by legal briefs, however, than career briefs, as diverse as real estate developer, restaurateur, innkeeper, chef, and cookbook author, and more significantly, social entrepreneur working with inner-city homeless and AIDS communities, social and nonprofit housing. Oh, and by the by, in full disclosure, my longtime friend, indeed one of my college, and at that time nearly jail-time roommates.
As long as I've known you, your relationship to your spiritual practice has been turned outward. You're one of the most engaged people I know and have been since earliest days. Why do you express your spirituality in that way so naturally?
Well, interesting question. I think that my entrance into spiritual practice, in a sense, was from the outside, in a way. So, and as you know, since we were together for much of it, early on, as I became a sort of young adult, off in college, I got very involved in the political process. This was during the time of the anti-war movement, sort of late in the period around civil rights, and so my activity was sort of outward looking. And I think that for me, there was a piece that I felt was uncomfortable, which was, I think I figured out later on, was a sense of imbalance, that I really had no practice to understand my mind. I think I was sort of reactive to external stimulus, in sort of all the ways I did things. And so when, very coincidentally, I had the opportunity to intersect with Trungpa Rinpoche in 1970, I felt like I had kind of returned home in a certain way. And so, that then became a resting point for a short period of time. But then, partially because of my own restlessness, my own inspiration, and in large part because of Rinpoche's pushing, I ended up kind of looking out again, fairly quickly.
Early on in that period of time, after only a few years, you found yourself in law school. Did that happen by accident, or was that part of some view of where you thought you were going to be going and working in life?
Well, it's interesting. When I was younger, when I was in high school, I was pretty convinced that I would end up in law school. So that was the sort of trajectory, always on my mind. But when I started practicing in 1970 and then moved to Carmichael Chulling and became involved in the administration of Carmichael Chulling and so on.
And Carmichael Chulling is a Buddhist contemplative center in Vermont.
Thank you. Sorry for the jargon. I'll be more careful. So I lived in Barnet, Vermont, in this meditation center. Marty was there for a period of time, and along with other friends. And I made a kind of personal decision that I would kind of, that would become the career, that somehow I felt fulfilled. I enjoyed the fact that I could spend part of my day doing contemplative practice and part of my day satisfying my restlessness and kind of run around. I was the cook, I was the gardener, I did all those sorts of things. And at one point, this was in the time when Trungpa Rinpoche, who in later years became, a little less available because of the sheer number of students and the number of activities, was a little more available. I had a couple of conversations with him, and actually he said to me, what about law school? And I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, aren't you going to go to law school? And I said, well, no, I was thinking probably not anymore. And he looked just incredulous. And he said, but we need lawyers. And so I made this kind of deal that since he was about to move to Boulder, I said, well, I'll go to law school, but I have to go to the University of Colorado because I need to be in Boulder because I don't want to lose the opportunity to study with you. And that was fine, and it's ended up what I did. So in the mid-70s, went to the law school, University of Colorado, and for a period of time I was the interim director of the Boulder Meditation Center that we had here as a job, although for $72 every 2 weeks, I'm not sure how much of a job it was. But that allowed me to kind of get back into the earlier passion that I had. I did a lot of work, started focusing a lot on nonprofit law, mental health law, and for me, what was most fulfilling, I think, is I spent a lot of time in the legal aid clinic. So as a student, I ended up in the courtroom a lot, which was a great opportunity for me, I guess partially because I like to talk, and so it gave me a chance to speak in these courtrooms, and knowing that I had a lawyer, a real lawyer, behind me to protect me. But it gave me an opportunity to start intersecting with low-income persons, people with mental illness, the kind of people that were getting the sort of public aid law. And that kind of charted a further course, I think, in terms of where I went with my future career.
Being a lawyer in and of itself would have been quite a career stream, even on the social side of law. But I know that in parallel with what you've already described in terms of your spiritual engagement and now your legal engagement, somehow you also, as far as I can tell, was simultaneously involved in business activities, entrepreneurial activities, what we would now call social entrepreneurism. But why so many things all at once?
Partially, and I say this somewhat tongue-in-cheek, but, I probably have some kind of undiagnosed ADD or something. I don't think I was cut out to sit in an office in a law firm, even though, I enjoyed the client interaction. I didn't enjoy as much the sort of stiff boundaries around the practice of law. I mean, it was tough to feel joy all the time. And so I was always interested as much in what my clients were doing when they were doing interesting things as I was, in my own law practice. And, I had a client in Boulder who was a real estate developer and conservationist, actually, a man named Jim Drescher. And Jim had an intention to move to Nova Scotia, which for people listening is where Marty currently lives, and where Trungpa Rinpoche was going to establish, an international headquarters for his work. And, with my wife Judy made the decision that we would move to Halifax in Nova Scotia, and Jim and I would start a company looking to basically do real estate development, but, in what today would be called infill development. We went to fairly low-income urban centers in Halifax and found properties, renovated them, creating housing and economic development opportunities. We did a lot of historic restoration at a time when, in Nova Scotia, tearing down historic properties was the norm. They were seen as basically not salvageable in many ways. And so we approached the development business from the perspective of the social impact of our projects as much as the financial, and considering we were thick in the middle of business in the midst of the very deep recession in the 1980s, the social impact ended up trumping because we didn't make very much money. But we built some really great projects. I was just in Halifax a couple of weeks ago visiting old friends, and drove by a few of them, and they still have legs. They look good. We have some blocks in Halifax that were totally run down and falling apart. And now there are, you know, there were new homes at the time, but, you know, now they're 20 years old or so. But I feel very good about that. And I think that as we were establishing the Buddhist community in Halifax, which understandably was looked at with some suspicion by the local residents, who were these Buddhists, why were they here, somehow being able to create bricks and mortar representations of who we were, what our values were, what our ethics were, I think was helpful in terms of how we were accepted as a community. You know, people looked at our houses and they look great, and I built a 42-room hotel, which is still there, and a restaurant, and, you know, saved 300-200-year-old buildings from being torn down, and, you know, it's still there making money for somebody. And so I was very happy about the opportunity to kind of express my, you know, my kind of spiritual understanding in a way. I kind of like the fact that, you know, you can sort of kick the tires when you're building something.
So it sounds also simple, but in real life, as you mentioned in passing, you didn't always make money on that or some of your other ventures, and it's been hard work. You didn't come up with the .com idea. What have you learned from the hard work of being in both business successfully and unsuccessfully?
Well, you know, I think it became clear early on that making a lot of money was not primary to me, although there were periods of time where I made a good living, and I certainly felt, you know, I kind of enjoyed having that, the freedom and flexibility that allowed. But for me, and, you know, it's important to say that these decisions that I've made about my career were really in partnership with Judy, my wife, who, as a senior Buddhist teacher, had her own career. She's, you know, she was the principal editor for Trungpa Rinpoche's work, still does a lot of that work, travels and teaches a lot. And so we made decisions together about, you know, where we were going to be, since, you know, Halifax was only one stop on what became several others. You know, I certainly didn't set out not to make money. I certainly didn't set out not to build businesses that were very successful.
Good thing.
That's exactly. But at the same time, and, you know, maybe my kids, when they ultimately have to read my will not be as happy about it. But the fact of the matter is that it became somewhat less important to me than doing things that I felt good about doing, and doing things that I felt had a kind of honest connection to at least what limited understanding I had about my Dharma practice, my spiritual practice, and how to be in the world, since Buddhist practice to me, you know, is basically all about how to be in the world. I mean, I think that's what it comes down to. And I have, for the most part, even with the financial failures and you know, more than financial failures, and sometimes not always been a great manager, I've always felt somehow that I've always been able to touch back to the practices that I was given by my teacher, and felt like I never, you know, moved very far, at least from maintaining that connection. I didn't necessarily always do a great job, but sort of it's always the running commentary in the back of my mind.
You said earlier, Chuck, that you had a restless element, and so as I'm, you know, as I'm seeing the dots here of, you know, working hard to establish a working pattern in Colorado, and then, you know, feeling an impetus to move to Nova Scotia, and knowing that then you worked hard there over a number of years to really create a basis of activity and cobble together a reasonable platform, and then next thing you knew, you're in Yonkers, New York.
That's
a
right.
Big change. And where did that come from?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, and just to go back, because I think I'm realizing now in thinking about this, I've kind of left something behind in each place I've been as well, which is kind of interesting. So going all the way back to my time in Boulder, you know, one of my first clients was the sort of emerging Naropa Institute, now Naropa University, and we helped set up the nonprofit company, corporation, which became Naropa University. We created the first board of trustees. I ended up with a seat on that board of trustees. And so even though I moved from Boulder to Halifax, I kept this little platform back in Boulder with Naropa, much the same way, I think, that when we left Halifax, which I'll talk about Judy because of her work editing Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings, which, you know, where the archives are located in Halifax, kept her platform in Nova Scotia. So we kind of all never quite left the places that we left, which I think is actually quite good. Has been at least fun for us to have reasons to keep going back to the places that we came from. You know, the New York move came from a couple of things. One is that our real estate business in Halifax was not doing that well in the midst of this recession. So financially, it was not a great situation. I definitely could have gotten a job in Nova Scotia. I'd met a lot of people, and I didn't feel, you know, I felt like I certainly could have gone to work someplace. But I had met, through my connections at Naropa, a Zen Buddhist teacher named Bernie Glassman, who was a student of Maizumi Roshi, one of the great Zen masters who came from Japan to the United States. And Bernie's own spiritual practice was deeply involved in social action work very early on. So this is, he was a true pioneer in that work of bringing Buddhist teaching to social action. And we had what was, in a sense, a conversation that we would have in half-hour snippets at Naropa board meetings three times a year for about 3 years. And so, you know, by the end of it, it was 4 or 5 hours of discussion. And at each one, he would ask me to move to New York. They were doing their work in a city called Yonkers, New York, fourth largest city in New York State, in Westchester County, which, you know, is one of the top two or three richest counties in the country. And at the time we were having our conversations, Yonkers had the highest per capita rate of homelessness anywhere in the United States, this total incongruity that surrounded by just incredible wealth, that hundreds of families were living in motels or worse. And so Bernie, who is a very seductive guy, very convincing, finally wore me down to a place where in 1992 I agreed to kind of check it out. And there was a part that was kind of, you know, there's a cheesy part to all this in a way, because early in 1992 I got very, very sick in this kind of emergency way. I started bleeding internally, and I had this emergency surgery, and, you know, I can't exactly say that my life flashed in front of me, but definitely for somebody who I don't think, you know, I never really stopped. I doubt I ever had a sick day. So for somebody who was then forced for 3 or 4 weeks to sort of sit around and consider what was next, it became an opportunity for me to actually think through what my next move should be. And talking with Judy and with our kids, decided that checking out Yonkers and what is still called the Grayston Foundation was something that was worth doing. So I traveled there, and, you know, I hedged my bets. I didn't commit to working there, but I said I would go down for a few weeks, see what it was like. And I fell in love with the work. So basically arranged my life so that in 1993 we made the move down to New York. I became the first president of Grayston, managed to convince a few of my friends who were also students of Trungpa Rinpoche, notably David Rome, who was a very senior student of Trungpa Rinpoche's, to join me. Later we have Derek Collini, who is one of the preeminent translators of Tibetan works in our Sangha, became the CFO. We had a number of people that came through who were students as well. And we brought, you know, our kind of Tibetan Buddhist understanding to what was a project of the Zen community of New York. And created some thunderstorms from time to time, because we really do have two different paths, although coming, obviously, arising from the Buddha's teaching. But it was a wonderful opportunity, which I can, you know, I can describe a little bit more. But basically, we got to Grayson, there were about 15 employees or so. And 10 years later, when I left, we had 180 employees and had done, I think, some really extraordinary work. So for me, it was a move. I had a real passion to make that move, and it was an exceptional time in my life.
What those employees point to, and I want to give you a chance to talk about, is where the work was focused. Some of it was around homelessness, some was around AIDS, and one I really would like you to find a way to talk about, because I know that you're a person who layers in different parts of your life somehow. You mentioned early on you did some cooking at back in Vermont in Contemplative right. Center. I know you were a hotelier back in your Western U.S. days, and then you mentioned a hotel. And I know you also had it in Halifax, and you had a reputation also as a cook and a chef and this and that. Well, the bakery. Make sure you lace in something about the marvelous bakery at Grayston.
Sure. I'll talk briefly about Grayston's generally. We built permanent housing for formerly homeless families in a time when the conventional wisdom in social service was to make transitional housing, housing that you offered to people for a year or two with this expectation that somehow giving them a house to live in, an apartment to live in, was going to allow them to pull themselves up by their bootstraps and get out in the world and make a living, go buy a house or rent a big apartment or whatever. We had a somewhat different model and basically said, these are people that we're working with and that we're serving who have been battered around for most of their lives and for whom everything has always been transitional. And so our model was to break that unpredictability and to give people an opportunity to get out of these motels, get off the streets in some cases, and to get into housing that was both well-built, and we got criticism for that because we actually insisted on spending the additional money that it took to put in soundproofing between units, to put in hardwood floors instead of crappy flooring, to those sorts of things. But feeling that, you know, the conventional wisdom, again, was that you could do the minimum and basically, who were they to complain? And our view was...
So that is some richness.
Yeah, our view was that one way in which people can move out of poverty, and more importantly, the sort of mentality of poverty, was to provide them with richness, to provide them with a dignified environment. And I don't mean precious. I mean, you know, people were sloppy housekeepers or not. That was irrelevant. The point was, it was an opportunity for them to live in the kind of place that I would live in. And I thought that that was important. So we built that housing. We worked with people to get them connected with employment, which meant we realized that we needed to do something about the fact that they all had, or many of the families that we served, and it was a lot of single women, had young children. So we created a child care center, which still to this day is probably the best child care center in Westchester. So for what was a mostly publicly funded center, it is as good as the centers that people are paying $1,500 a month to send their kids to, and I'm totally very proud of that. And then we also moved into healthcare because we realized, especially in the early 90s, inevitably we were working with a lot of people whose lives were touched with HIV/AIDS and were, again, they were receiving healthcare in the way that poor people had received healthcare for decades, which is they had to go into the emergency room. And they would have to wait for 8 hours or 10 hours, and they would get service that was incredibly expensive and also not that great because of just the sheer weight of, you know, the burden on emergency rooms. And so we started providing health care for people living with AIDS, opened up an adult day health center where people could come 3 or 4 or 5 days a week. They could get health care, they could get social skills, they could make friends, they could create a community. We built housing specifically for people living with AIDS named Isan House, named for a great Western Buddhist monk who himself lived and then died from AIDS, who served that population, a man named Isan Dorsey. We created this day program, as I said, which was called the Maitri Center, Maitri meaning loving kindness in Sanskrit. And those programs still exist today, so and are doing very well. Grayson was most known, however, for its bakery. And, you know, I come at it, as Marty said, my relationship to food is bizarre and goes back a long way. My first job at 14, I took the bus every afternoon after school when I was 14, and I worked in a kitchen of a nursing home in Cleveland, Ohio, where my job principally was taking the food that was to be served to most of the residents in the nursing home, stick it in a blender, grind it up, and feed it to the nursing home residents who couldn't chew. And it was so offensive to me that it made me realize that I had to understand more about cooking, because it made no sense to me that people should be subjected to that kind of thing. So somehow I got this cooking thing in my blood. It followed when I was about 16 years old, very different kind of food karma. I ended up as the manager of the popcorn manufacturing concession for the Cleveland Indians and the Cleveland Browns, which probably for a teenage boy was the best job you could get. So I went to, I saw the last two quarters of every football game, and I saw the last three innings of every home baseball game, and in the meantime I was making popcorn. So I had this kind of, so food was around me. And then, as I said earlier, when I got to Carmen Schilling, for some reason I was somebody that they thought could cook, and so they said, well, you can run the kitchen. And following that, I made this, when I made my relationship with Trungpa Rinpoche, I ended up becoming an early cook for him. And I don't know why, since his later cooks were far more accomplished than I was, but somehow my relationship with him ended up always around food. And so on and on and on. But somehow I had this connection with food. When we were in Halifax, we opened this hotel. I ended up taking a couple of years managing it and running the restaurant. And that's where I kind of honed my, I wasn't really the chef, but I wrote the menus and I worked with the chefs. And that's where I kind of really kind of honed whatever little skill I have. And we were early pioneers in starting what today is very common, this sort of farm-to-plate movement, which in the late 80s was just unheard of. But we made connections with local farmers and growers, and we cooked local food, and as a result of which, I ended up writing a couple of cookbooks around those themes, which was kind of fun and bizarre thing.
In your spare time, a couple of cookbooks.
Yeah, it was in my spare time. It was all kind of a lot of work. I had a partner, happily, but... It was kind of fun to do. But somehow I arrived at Greyston, you know, with my sort of Buddhist practice and definitely with my food passion. And interestingly, Bernie Glassman's kind of seminal teaching ended up in a book called Instructions to the Cook, which is from an old Zen story about Dogen, who was a famous Zen Buddhist teacher, where his entire teaching methodology was basically providing the practitioner with all the ingredients that one needs to live a fulfilled spiritual and secular life. And somehow that was a perfect connection for me. Long way getting back to the Greyston Bakery. But the bakery emerged because it was clear to us in Yonkers that really allowing people to transform out of poverty was going to require getting people linked to employment. You know, housing was great, healthcare was great, childcare was great, but at the end of the day, being reliant on those services being paid for by the government was a temporary at best solution. And so we built, when I say we, Bernie started it and then we grew it. We built what was a wholesale bakery. Initially, it was making kind of cakes and pies and high-end things for restaurants in New York. Not making a lot of money, but allowed us to hire some people. The sort of seminal moment for the Greyston Bakery happened actually back in Boulder, up above Boulder in the mountain town of Gold Hill, where Bernie Glassman went to a conference in the late 80s, of a group of people who later founded an organization called the Social Venture Network. This was a kind of very early manifestation of people that didn't really know it, but were involved in social enterprise. And social enterprise was not a thing at that point, but that's where it emerged. one of the places. And he ended up taking a famous walk around the lake at Gold Hill with a guy named Ben Cohn, who is the Ben of Ben and Jerry's. And Bernie said, well, we have this bakery. Is there anything we can do to connect with what you do? And Ben said, well, we have a few ice cream flavors that use baked goods, notably brownies. And if you can bake the brownie, we'll consider buying it from you. But it has to be exactly the same brownie that we're already using, and we're buying it from a third-party bakery, so we don't own the recipe, so we can't tell you how to make it. All we can do is tell you, if you do make it, we'll buy it from you. And that started years of experimentation, some of which was before I arrived, and then some afterward, of buying gallons of ice cream, melting away the ice cream, taking the brownie, deconstructing it, going through this whole thing. We finally, long story short, perfected the brownie. Grayston is now providing about 6 or 7 million pounds a year of brownies, which go from Yonkers, New York, up to Vermont, to the Ben & Jerry's plant. And most importantly, it allowed us to hire, today I think the bakery has 75 or 80 employees, who are paid a reasonable wage, who have opportunities for rising up through the bakery, or have the opportunity, based on the skills that they learn, to work elsewhere. And the bakery's model, I think, is the exceptional part of the story, is, and it's still the case today, if there's a job open at the bakery, the first person that walks in the door to ask for it gets it. No one looks at a resume, no one looks at history, because in most cases that history in other employment situations would have closed the door immediately, because a lot of the folks at the bakery were in prison, had issues around substance abuse. They had a tough past. And so the bakery's model always was, we're going to take everybody as we find them, and it's completely up to the individual who arrives in working with their peers to make it work or not. And frankly, as a result, there's a fair amount of turnover, because some people are just simply not ready. In which case, we'll help connect them with other kinds of social services and hope that they'll come back. But, you know, for the many people who are, the bakery has been either a long-term home and a real career path, or I'd say for the majority of people was a springboard to other kinds of employment. And so we're pretty proud of that model.
This concludes part one of our conversation with Chuck Leaf. Tune in next time for the conclusion. You have been listening to Cooking Rice on Chronicles Radio. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listening audience. To contribute, go to chroniclesradio.com and click on Support This Work. Thank you for joining us today.